Okay, so as I said, the recorder's going. Once we, I hope that while I was gone, you decided on who's going to be the facilitator.
No, we were just chatting.
Yeah. Okay. So I have this instructions for the facilitator. Would anyone, is anyone like the facilitator type here or would like to do that? Or am I by default?
You should have been here first.
Oh, did you want to be the facilitator?
I'd gladly do it.
Okay. These are the instructions. I should have brought two so I can read. Does anyone else happen to have the facilitator instructions? Okay. Anyway, the first thing on the instructions is to get everyone to sign this pink sheet. So I'll start passing that around. Okay. We can take care of that. The other thing that I was told is introduce yourself. Each time you speak,
yes,
say your name again, because obviously...
It's being recorded.
Okay.
This is for the benefit of the recorder.
Yes.
Make sure everybody speaks once. Nobody speaks twice. Then when we go the second time, whatever the topic we're talking, you wait till you only get to talk once the second time.
The purpose of this group is to each share our stories.
Right. Yeah.
So ideally, as Rugsy is suggesting, we share our story without a discussion about our story, and then the second time around, we can comment on other people's what other people shared. How does that sound for a strategy? Michelle's reading the instructions, so let's let her do that. But I think generally, that sounds like a plan we can start with, right?
Whoever needs to sit at the end, whoever's going to facilitate, so I can see them.
She's at this end.
Yeah. We don't need to move to the end to be a facilitator.
Is your recorder pick up from the end of the table?
We can move the recorder around.
We'll just move
it around.
Is this the recorder?
This is the recorder.
Okay. Okay. Is it going now?
It is on.
It's on.
So we could start, because the first time we're supposed to just talk for 15, 20 seconds, say where we were.
Like we did there.
Yeah. So let him, you start.
Are you going to be the facilitator?
I'm giving Michelle a minute to read the facilitator instructions. The general plan is that we're going to each share our stories, and then we can share similar stories. We can ask questions, clarify where we were, and kind of help to build our group history. Because the reason we were all assigned here is we were either in Virginia or North Carolina, is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Okay, who would like to be a timekeeper? You have actually to set it up, the phone timer should chime after 4.5 minutes, so speakers have 30 seconds to finish.
Sounds good.
The 5 minute initial time is based on a group of eight or fewer. So we have got eight.
Yeah.
You're in a group of so we've got
this
eight.
This is to tell our story.
Announce for the recording the discussion topic, date, and time. And that would be, we want these discussions to be an exploration rather than a debate where people argue for a correct position. So that means each person can get their thoughts together, okay, on what you want to say, because you have a time limit. Mm-hmm. And you want to get in the important things. All right, everyone goes around the table, and in 15 seconds, this is the first thing we're going to do, give their name, where and when they worked in the South. For example, I'm Junebug Jones, and I worked in Yoknapatawpha County in summer of 1965. Is that a joke, or is that really a county, Andy?
It's a county that William Faulkner used when he was writing his novels in Mississippi.
All right. Begin the discussion by asking Freedom Movement veterans to address the topic for 4 to 5 minutes, followed by others. If the group is larger than 8, the time limit would be shortened, of course.
So, Michelle, may I interrupt? Those are general guidelines for discussions in general. Specifically,
right.
This one is to share our stories.
Right.
There's another
right.
discussion
right.
group on a topic.
Okay, the rule. First rule, speakers must say their name for the transcriber or the speaker. Second rule, everyone has an equal right to be heard. And because we're telling our stories, you know what time you have. Mm-hmm. Third rule, stay on topic with digressions into other areas, without digressions into other. That's why you need a few minutes to think about what you're going to say or make notes on what you really want to say. Mm-hmm. After everyone has spoken, facilitate a group discussion. Do you want us to go into the group discussion?
Well,
or
after everyone's spoken
the
first time around, we'll check, see how much time we have,
okay.
and we can decide what we
All
want
right.
to do, I think.
So after each one is going around, just like Lanny said, if there is time left, then we will facilitate a group discussion with responses limited to 2 minutes, okay? So you may want to ask somebody else. You have to say your name first, of course, mm-hmm. and whom you're asking. Questions about what they gave on their exploration. Mm-hmm. After the discussion, bring the filled-in sign. Okay, as facilitator, you should participate in the discussion the same as anyone else. On the other hand, it's not your job to interpret or contextualize other participants' comments, nor should you dominate the meeting. Okay, so the rules are already set. Okay, 4.5 is a good timekeeper.
I can. I've got a timer right
oh,
here.
Oh, good. That's
yeah.
great.
Yeah.
All right, and
I'm Charles.
Yeah, maybe we better put these cards up
yeah,
a little
sure.
bit
yeah.
so we can know who. Okay, even though we're going to introduce ourselves.
Right, yeah,
okay. So, is the pink sheet going around? Yes,
yes,
it's going to everybody but Michelle.
Yeah. No, I haven't signed it yet either.
Okay. And I have a pencil.
and you all should have signed a release?
Yes.
At some point.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that'll
do. Be thinking of what you're going to say.
The first time around, we're just going to be, it's going to be very short, just to introduce ourselves. And
it's
then
just
the second
15
round,
seconds.
It's the 5 minute thing.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay, Lanny, I'm coming to you with this.
Okay, we can go ahead and,
yes.
and get started.
Okay, so we have our timekeeper is...
Well, I just for the initial, Charles. I'm Charles.
Okay,
yeah,
Charles.
Yeah, we can just start around very quickly, and then the first one who starts, I'll punch the button.
Okay,
yeah,
we will start with Lanny.
Okay, good, okay.
Okay, I'm Lanny Coffer. I served in Sussex County, Virginia in the summer of 1965 with the Scope Project. I also returned for a few weeks in 1966.
Yeah. My name is Charles Buell. I work very near Lanny in Surrey County, Virginia, the summer of 1965 and returned very briefly for a long weekend visit in 1966.
My name is Peggy Poole. I was Peggy Ryan then. I worked in Sussex County, Virginia in the summer of 1965.
My name is Kathy Lass, and I worked with Scope the summer of 65 in Southampton County, Virginia.
My name is Jennifer Westerman. At the time, my name was Jennifer Sather. I worked with Kathy in Southampton County, Virginia. And I guess I don't have to go where I live now.
My name is Ruggsy Ruggiero. I work for Scope in the summer of 65. I work for SCLC the next 6 months in the Springfield movement in Springfield, Massachusetts, recruiting people to go south to the next summer.
In the south, where did you work?
Martin County, North Carolina. Excuse me.
Don't do that.
I'm Al Campan. I worked in Lunenburg County in the summer of 65. I also participated in the Birmingham Project on the Christmas break of 1965.
I am Michelle Hutchinson, and I was attending Johnson C. Smith University. They asked a group of us to work with SCOPE. We went to train at Morris Brown College, and I worked in Lewisburg, North Carolina, Kingstree, and Newberry. I worked in Birmingham and Montgomery and Selma, Alabama, and in Mississippi. Now, let's start with our explorations. Have you had enough time to put down exactly what you want to say if everybody just says yes or no?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Let's start with Lanny again.
Okay. So, Peggy Poole, formerly Ryan, is here, and I were two of about eight SCOPE workers in Sussex County. So I'll share some of my history and Peggy can fill in the gaps. The thing that was unique about Sussex County was the leadership of Sussex County, the white leadership. There was one man, his name was Garland Gray. He owned the peanut business, which employed most of the African-American workers. He also owned the sawmill and had the rights to log the pine trees for the sawmill. And so the rest of the black folks that didn't work in the peanut fields worked for him in the sawmill or out logging, you know, related to that. And most of them lived in his employee housing. So he was their boss and their landlord, and he was the president of the bank, and he was the state senator. So he had complete control of this county. Everybody answered to him, white or black. Mm-hmm. So I think this was one of the voter registration, of course, was very low, as it was in all the counties that where the SCOPE project went. But I think because of that power structure, Sussex County was targeted. In fact, we were sent first to a different county, and then they moved us to Sussex. They decided that was where they really needed the work. So we got there, and the young people immediately gravitated to us, and they really were the spark that lit the fire in Sussex County. I was assigned to the town of Waverly, Virginia. We had workers in three different towns in Sussex County. All the towns in Sussex were on the borders of the county, and the whole middle part of the county was pine forest and peanut fields, and the courthouse was right in the center of the county, not near anything, and that's also where the black school was. So this was 11 years after Brown versus Board of Education. The schools were still completely segregated. The white kids went down the street in their town to their schools. The black kids were bussed out into the school out by the courthouse. So we found out right away that our main obstacle was that the registrar's office was only open one day a month for 6 hours, first Monday of the month. So we started the steps of nonviolent action by requesting that they open the office hours up. We requested a Saturday because people worked, and obviously they couldn't get off work and tell their Mr. Gray that they were going to register to vote. They'd have to call in sick and lie and take the whole day off. So we asked for a Saturday, and the registrar said, well, there's nobody coming in now on this one Monday, so why should I open more hours? So we worked under Herbert Colton. May he rest in peace. He just passed away about 2 weeks ago. He was the field secretary for Virginia and some other states. Mm-hmm. So he was, we definitely did what he told us to do. We were just the worker bees. And he said we got to have a demonstration. So we organized a march. And who really organized this march was these kids. They staffed our little office that we set up in the back room of a church. They went out and they got their parents to join this movement. They organized their own little march around the black side of town. The railroad tracks divided the town between black and white. They organized their own march, and we joined in with them. We taught them the freedom songs, and we marched around our side of town. And you could see the parents looking out the windows. They were sitting on the porches, checking it all out. And the kids went home and said, there's going to be a meeting. You know, you need to come to this meeting. Some of them came, and then gradually they joined in. So all of that culminated in this protest at the courthouse. We marched from the different locations. Well, we drove to a point a mile or so from the courthouse because we couldn't march the 15 miles or whatever it was all the way to the courthouse. We could have, but we chose to march for about a mile to the courthouse. We met at the courthouse. We had a rally. We had about 150 people or so, which was remarkable for what these people were risking, their house, their job, their loan at the bank, etc. And we thought it was a big success. The kids sat down in the hallways. They wanted to just have a sit-in and keep it going, but we said, that's not time yet. Be patient. We're just doing this by steps. Is it 30 seconds now?
No, don't. Yeah. You don't have to do that. Just look here.
Okay, thank you. So we had our march. It was a success, but they still didn't open the office, so we kept on demonstrating and demonstrating. We got action was we got as many people as we could, close to 200 people out on that Monday.
Wonderful.
The registrar came in early and stayed late to get everybody registered. But he said, we got everybody registered. We proved that one day a month is still enough.
Yeah.
So finally, when the Voting Rights Act passed in August, we drove to Washington, D.C., to the Justice Department. They contacted the county. They said, we're going to send federal registrars down there and take over your registering operation if you don't open up these hours. And they opened up the hours. And then we could finally do the job we were sent to, which was to go door to door and arrange for people to get rides and to get down to register to vote.
What a success story. Thank you.
Great.
You're so organized, we gave you an extra minute.
Go ahead. Why don't you?
Okay, hold on a second. I got to stop and then reset. And okay.
All right.
I'll time keep for you.
Yeah. Well, yeah, come on. Start. Yeah.
Hold this up when you have your okay.
Yeah, my name is Charles Buell. I served in Surrey County, Virginia, in the summer of 1965. We had three people assigned to us, all from different backgrounds. Myself, I was a grad student at NYU. Alan Wolf from Heidelberg College in Ohio. Bob Waterman from University of California, Santa Barbara. We had a Surrey County is a very rural county, which others are too, but there was no central town there, and there was no central economic force there. There were a few larger farms, there were a few workers on those farms, but that was not central to the economy. Surrey County is located on the banks of the James River, just opposite Williamsburg. Some people that took the ferry across and worked at Williamsburg. Other people would work either in the Smithfield packing companies in Isle of Wight County, which is just to the east. Some would drive a little further to the east to the Norfolk shipyards. On the other side, one of our key leaders worked as a technical in the technical side of a chemical company in Petersburg. So it was almost an early version of a commuter a place, which had its pluses and minuses. The employment rate was pretty high there. Obviously, the whites did better than the black population, but there was work to be had, and there had been a reasonable number of people in the very low hundreds, 150, 200 black people registered to vote, and they were tended to be the leaders. They were definitely outnumbered by the white voters, but the total black population in Surrey was pretty much two-thirds black. So it certainly wasn't even. We had a real benefit of having good, strong local black leadership. Charles Petaway worked in the Norfolk shipyards and was had founded the Surrey County Improvement Society. That was a time of black improvement societies. He was active in that. Edward Johns, a neighbor of his, he was the one who worked in Petersburg, was also very active. Thomas Hardy, on the other side, had a number of different jobs, fairly middle class jobs. So there was a good cadre of black leadership there. The issue was trying to get people to vote. We did not have mass meetings. There were a few younger kids, who would help us. There wasn't the kind of pressure and the kind of really overt discrimination that other counties had, and that was a barrier for us. Certainly better for blacks to live in Surrey than Sussex or some of the other counties, but still, it was a barrier. And but we did go out. There weren't too many barriers to register. I forget exactly how often it was open, but the scheduling was not a huge issue, as I recall. But just getting the people into the into the registering was an issue. And as I copied a letter which I had received later that fall, we had significantly increased the number of voters to about 500, but Edward John said only about half of them came out to vote in the November elections. So it was that part. Not only do you get them to register, but you have to learn to actually get out the vote, which is a current issue even today. I think those within my time frame, I think that's about what I say here, and certainly can open up for other questions.
And that was Charles Buell.
That was Charles. That was Charles Buell. Yeah.
And just clarification.
Tell you who you said you are. Let's not make any changes. Tell who you are.
Yeah. My name is Peggy Poole. I'd like to ask a clarification question.
Yes.
If that's all right. So is this our story that we're to be talking about now?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. And you are Michelle?
Yeah.
Is that right?
That's right.
Okay, yeah. I didn't see your name. Okay, so again, my name is Peggy Poole. I was in Sussex County in Virginia. So my story, I was an 18-year-old college student in my first year of college at Chico State in California. I had a friend that had participated in Freedom Summer with SNCC in Mississippi, which had really electrified me in terms of my interest and commitment. So I had applied first with SNCC, but their program started earlier before my college got out, and then I applied with Scope and was accepted. So I came to Atlanta on my own. It was a 4-day train journey. But to get there, I knew that my parents would not agree with this. And so I actually went to the health service and asked to meet with a psychologist at Chico State. And I said, okay, so how do I do this? They're going to say no. And he said, write them a letter. That way, if they say no, they say no without you in front of them, then they can go back on it later. Mm-hmm. I said, okay, that's good advice. So I did that. I wrote him a letter saying that, you know, what I wanted to do and how I was going to pay for it and so forth.
And they got the letter, and the letter ended up as now, my father gave it to our assemblyman from our area, Jerome Waldy, who actually was Antioch. And it's read into the assembly record, and I've got a copy of it from March of 1965, so they couldn't say no. And so anyway, I went down to Atlanta. And at that time, although there were eventually 8 people that came to that worked in Sussex County, there were only the 3 fellows from UC Santa Barbara in Atlanta. And so Scope put me with Lanny, Phil, and Gary. And the 4 of us drove up to Sussex County. We didn't first go to Sussex because when SCLC had put out the requests to see if they wanted someone, no one answered. So first we were in Prince George, but we just drove into Sussex and we met the young people, as Lanny said, and that kind of took things over. One thing that Lanny really laid out what happened in terms of voting, but we also got people together to found the Sussex County Improvement Association. Went to the city council meeting in Waverly and had almost 50 of the black residents of Waverly show up, which was a real shock for the establishment there. There was also some integration of restaurants, and we inadvertently went to a laundromat just to do the laundry, and not realizing that it was only for white clothes, and the guy just flipped out and locked us in, and then wouldn't let us, and then he was like, threw the clothes on the floor, but that was just inadvertently. And after that summer, I came back to Chico. At that point, Vietnam really, the anti-Vietnam movement really took off. And I became involved in that. But the experience changed my life. The love, the support, and the bravery of the people in Sussex County who remained there, living in shacks, living in unpaved streets. At best, they were, you know. There was no health care. There was one white doctor who would, after he finished his day, if somebody had, you had to go to the back door if you were black, didn't matter. I mean, then he would fit you in if he felt like it, and if he didn't, he didn't. And the closest medical care was Petersburg, and there was no public transportation. And as Lanny said, the only black school was in the middle of the county, and there was one bus, and if you wanted to play on any sports teams or do music, which wasn't organized by the school, you missed the bus, and so the young people were deprived of a lot of things. But like I said, it was very inspirational. It definitely changed my life and made me much more of an activist, and it's an experience I was very grateful for.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, I am Kathy Lass, and again, I served in Southampton County, Virginia in 65 with Scope. As I mentioned previously, Southampton County is the home of Nat Turner. And when I went there, I was surprised to see, even then, 50 years ago, there were markers announcing that this was the site of the biggest slave rebellion in American history. So they had the marker there, but the area was highly segregated. I'm going to do a little bit of the pre. And because I think several people experienced the reaction of parents. My parents and principal were, of course, all for the idea. When I announced I was going, I was 22 at the time, I just graduated college, was going on to grad school. And they were worried because the year before, the 3 civil rights workers were killed, and they were very nervous. There was a lot of pressure, but I must have had the strength somehow, because, you know, there are few times in life when you know what's right and what's wrong and are able to act on it. And this one I knew and I felt, and my mother drove me to the Greyhound bus station in St. Louis in tears. I remember that very well. We got down to Atlanta for a week of orientation, and it was a very good experience, very well organized. We were walked through what to do in certain situations we might encounter, and got to know some other people. I was assigned to a group of four, one of whom will speak after me, and there were two other people with the group. One has passed away. His name was Michael Ross, and he was quite a guy. Michael, I'll jump ahead to when our summer was over. He called me about a year later. I was living in D.C. at the time, and he announced that he had become a Black Panther and that the mayor of Seattle had asked him to leave town. And we talked a little bit, and then he said, I got to get off the phone. I think my phone's being tapped. Well, and I tried to find him on the internet years after that, and I couldn't because his name was fairly common. And I find out from Joe Freeman that he ended up being elected to the city council in Seattle. And she said he's not the only Black Panther. Bobby Rush in Chicago, I think, is still on the city council. And he was a very eloquent speaker. And then the fourth gentleman, Don...
Arnold.
Arnold. We're not sure what happened to Don Arnold. There were four of us. Don had a turquoise Volkswagen, which we used as our transportation. Turquoise Volkswagens were rare in the South. And a little bug, and we stood out like a sore thumb. But that was fine. Michael was African American. The other three of us were white. Just a few little incidents. I mean, it was an incredible period of time for us. We went to Black churches just about every Sunday and introduced ourselves and asked for a place to stay, explained what we were doing. And in the beginning, maybe there was a tiny bit of reluctance on the part of some people because they were being threatened by some white families. Don't you take those people in. But after a while, I think we became kind of a status symbol. You know, after a church service and we spoke, people would come up and say, oh, stay with us, stay with us, stay with us, which was wonderful. So we were very well treated by the population. And I don't remember that I knew the Voting Rights Act had not been passed in June. So we just went about our business like it was, and folks down there didn't know any difference. So we registered a lot of voters. One couple I remember in particular, 30 seconds, oh my gosh. Maddie and Henry Blow were an older couple who we stayed with, and Maddie put her hands on my shoulder one day at breakfast and said, Jesus sent you. First of all, it was very humbling and embarrassing. Secondly, I'm Jewish, so it was just... And I went, well, I don't know, Ms. Blow. But she said all the white women said they would take their laundry, their ironing away from her if she kept us there. And she said, well, you go right ahead. And they didn't. The most startling thing that Jennifer and I both remember was going to a drive-in and having two booths, the white and the colored, and then we got into the parking lot and there was a big wall in the middle, the white cars on one side, the colored cars on the other. It was an incredible experience. I sometimes wonder after we left if we left behind more good then we maybe stirred up trouble for people.
Always.
And I've talked to one couple we stayed with very recently, and he was doing fine. So I'm out of time.
Yep.
Okay.
There'll be more.
Okay. Thank you.
I'm Jennifer Westerman. I was in Southampton County in the summer of 1965. I read an article in the Oregon State University newspaper, but they were looking for volunteers. And so I contacted the humanities professor who was sort of organizing. And they got money together for a bus ticket for me, so I took the Greyhound bus from Sweet Home, Oregon to Atlanta, 3-day trip, throwing up most of the way. And it was not a pleasant experience, but I get to see the Rocky Mountains on the way, and that was quite beautiful. But don't ever eat a Salisbury steak in the Monroe, Louisiana bus station. You will thank me later if you never do it. I was going to tell the story about the drive-in theater because it was so stands out in my mind. We went to that drive-in at least 3 times, you know, for entertainment in the evening, arriving at one side or the other, and I was thinking, this is a cool place. Sometimes white people waited on us, sometimes black people waited on it. I said, well, this is kind of nice. And then we realized that there was at least a 6-foot-high fence down the center of the drive-in, and it came, you know, it just highlighted the inanity of Jim Crow laws. And another one is the example already given of the laundromat. You know, complete inanity. I was 19 years old at the time, just finished my first year at Oregon State. Kathy was a graduate of Northwestern. I was very, very impressed, and she taught me so much about life. And even though we haven't seen each other for 50 years, she has never left my consciousness.
Yes.
So I will pass the baton now.
Likewise.
Think I probably...
Thank you.
Your turn.
Sure. My name is Greg Z. Ruggiero. Just like Lenny, the city I worked in North Carolina, the black people lived on one side of the tracks, the white people on the other side. To recruit people to attempt to register them to vote, we went to the black churches, we went walked through the fields to find people living on old plantations, really poor people, and we canvassed 2 different cities, Williamson, where I stayed at, with a real great woman named Sarah Small, and Hosea Williams and Golden Franks. The first 3 weeks would show up about every twice during the week to see how we were going. So they were running it because Hosea lived in North Carolina, and Golden Franks established, I don't know if any of you know, Freedom City in North Carolina. He did that a few years later. He makes a great spaghetti. I'm Italian, and he was so So, again, to the voting right thing, yeah, that hadn't been passed, but the restaurant thing had been passed. So I'll go through that first. What we did, we attempted to segregate about 15 restaurants, 2 white people, 2 black people over an 8-week period. We'd go into the restaurant. Obviously, it said white only. And then they'd say, oh, the color goes black. We'd be happy to serve you white people. The black people know to go out back. Well, there's no roof. There's no shade. You know, just a simple park bench. And the restrooms were just the trees. For the black people. And, you know, we said, no, there's the Civil Rights Act of 64. You have to serve us. That's the law. We'd stay there 20 minutes to 30 minutes, and when they didn't serve us, we'd call Atlanta and they'd file suit in federal government. The only place that we didn't desegregate, but we did, this is before McDonald's or something like this. There was this real tiny little thing on the white side of the town where you walked up and got ice cream and hamburgers. And it wasn't big enough to have any fences. And since kids, at the time I was a jock, kids have, excuse the French, brass balls. So we get in line, it'd be 3 or 4 white people, it'd be a couple of the black people with us, and somebody go, where'd you get those boots? Well, I got mine in Selma. You know, I mean, we were putting the screws into them, and it worked. So that was the only place that we did desegregate as far as eating. When it comes to voting, 2 people, there were only 2 African-American people registered to vote, even though there were 10,000 people eligible.
Wow.
To register to vote, like Lenny said, it was a supreme act of courage. You would lose your job, house, get run out of town. That was a good one, news. You could be lynched, tarred and feathered, you know, or killed. I mean, you know, whites had the, they were on top, and they could only stay on top with the vote. So they loved the way the system was, so that's why they fought the same way the leader Resielsi said today. Just so violently back, and they always keep trying. So eventually, after 3 weeks, we had 20 brave souls who wanted to register to vote. We go down there, and we go in, because that was on the white side of town. That was the first time I really had seen it, except for the place that we ate at. And when we walked in, the county clerk had a lame excuse. You wouldn't believe it. We all just ran out of form. But y'all come back here next week, and we'll have some for you. Okay, well, we'll give it a try, because we're there for 9 weeks. So the next week we went back, and of course they had some other lame excuse why they couldn't register. So this time we called Atlanta, and they filed suit against the county and the clerk who had illegally not allowed these people to register to vote. It's the type of thing that in eastern part of North Carolina, they only had 2% of African American. I mean, the county I was in, it was 2 people out of 10,000. I don't know if there are 40,000, and that would be 2%, so that would be 400. So we didn't really, we were not really any success on that except getting the suits filed. I love to talk, but I'll let somebody else talk. Okay.
Okay, I'm Al Campan, and in the summer of 65, I was just finishing college at a Calvin College in Grand Rapids, Michigan. So this is a college closely affiliated with the Christian Reformed Church, which is not known for its liberalism. I was in the process of the 4 years at Calvin. I did learn social consciousness. And I was planning to go to graduate school, and when I learned that I was going to get an assistantship, I recognized that I didn't have to work all summer to earn money and could use the opportunity to join the SCOPE program. I learned about it very late in the spring, so I quickly contacted a contact person in Chicago and took a train to Chicago, joined with a couple of students there for the ride to Atlanta. So the orientation program was a tremendous experience that really opened my eyes to the situation, and also appreciated the training in nonviolent direct action that we got there. We were assigned, I was assigned with four other students, four other volunteers to Lunenburg County in Virginia, which is again a rural county. Mm-hmm. What I recall is largely tobacco farms, as we got there, we joined two other students from the Virginia Student Civil Rights Council, who had already set up some activities there, and they were very, very helpful. So there were in all seven of us in Lunenburg County. We also encountered the very short hours of registration in Lunenburg. The county registrar was open from 10 a.m. until 2 p.m. on Thursdays, two Thursdays a month. So I guess we had a few more hours than Surrey County or Sussex. But it was on Thursdays. But nevertheless, until the Voting Rights Act was passed, we did the survey of the people, mainly in the black community. And my role, as I recall, was I set out on foot through the rural roads by myself. The danger, I think, in Virginia was not so great, for a male. The two women who were from the SCOPE project, they worked together. But so I have this map still with the county map as you have, Charles, with a list of the names of who lives on each one of these highways. So we compiled a list of potential voter registrants, and then recognizing the very short hours of registration, we organized a march. This march was held on August 3, on a Tuesday of the week that the Voting Rights Act was passed. I think it was August 5 or 6, that it was 6. All right. So we organized a march which had about 300 people marching from Victoria to Lunenburg Courthouse, which is where the courthouse was, about three or four miles. and that was very successful. But we learned the day of the march that the county politicians, people who were running the county, had instructed the county commissioners had instructed the registrar to expand the number of hours. So they announced before the march started that they were going to double the amount of hours for voter registration and include a Saturday. And we thought this was a huge, huge victory. It really was. It really was at the time. So there were then also going to be voter registration hours on Saturday from 10 a.m. until 2 p.m. And, of course, the first Saturday after the Voter Rights Act was passed was a big success. So we had a huge number of people. We felt a couple of hundred people that were able to register during that period. How much time do I have? I appreciated the opportunity to worship with the in the African American in the Black churches during the Sundays, and also make the contacts for the next place to stay, and in many cases also the Wednesday night prayer services and a couple of the rallies. Now, since the University of Chicago graduate school started late in September, I was able to stay for a couple more weeks after most of the Scope students left. And it was during this period of time that the KKK came into the county. So some of the prominent white business owners had invited the Ku Klux Klan to come in. And so they held a cross burning in just outside of the town where we had, just outside of Victoria. I remember it as about 30 feet high, although one of the newspaper articles calls it 100 feet high. But this was one. A couple of us went to watch from a distance to see the people in the hoods and marching around an oil soaked cross burning and singing all these gospel songs. It was a terrible, remarkable event. And we then helped the Black community organized a boycott of some of the businessmen who were instrumental in bringing the KKK into the country.
Great.
Mm-hmm.
Wonderful. Yeah. Yes. I'm Michelle Hutchinson, and it is important for me to tell you that I was in college at the time, and there were eight of us that decided that we would go with the Scope Project. And so we went to Morris Brown College, a historically Black college, for our training. Reverend Bolden was one of our trainers. Martin Luther King was there, James and Diane Bevel. And can't think of his name right now, but it'll come to me. Reverend Bolden didn't think we were taking it serious enough, hitting each other, but not hitting back, and bawling up, knocking each other down and bawling to protect our faces. So he hit us. He knocked us down. And that training, I'm telling you, saved our lives. I was in Lewisburg, North Carolina, that's Franklin County, King Street, and, of course, Birmingham, like I said, Montgomery, and Selma. In Selma, I was in Montgomery County, where I had the opportunity to meet Hattie. I'm losing my train of thought. At any rate, when we went to Birmingham, we were shot at. Several times they would come around in the middle of the night and we would be talking and we were shot at. Our main purpose was to teach the rural Black folk, because that's all we dealt with, the letters in their name and the letters in yes and no, and to get them to bring other rural Black folk to a meeting, secret meetings, okay? And we were successful there as far as organizing them, but
when they went to register, they were turned down over and over and over again. But we felt like we had accomplished something because they, as a group, continued to, in fact, to meet. When I went to Lewisburg County, we were picketing around the courthouse, and these men in trucks came, white men in trucks came, and beat us almost to death. I and three other people ended up in the hospital, and then we were in jail. The trustees, black trustees, were the ones that served us our food, so we couldn't take our clothes off or anything, because you never knew when this guy was coming in. You know, he was their trustee. He was curious about us females. When we were working in Selma, our purpose there was to register. And we did pretty good there because Selma had already been the focus of the civil rights movement, although that's not where it started. It started in South Carolina. Okay. When we went to, in August, when the Voting Rights Bill passed, we were back in Montgomery. And we were in a nursing home, a funeral home, rather, that was owned by a black man. And we were sitting on the floor, and across, you know, airwaves came to, in fact, tell us that, and we were glad. In Mississippi, Hattie Lou, I can't even think of her name.
Fannie Lou Hammer,
yes. Fannie Lou Hammer, we slept in her house. I should tell you, all of the black people who we stayed with, we worked in cotton fields, and they put on all these clothes on us every morning like they did themselves, and at the end of every row, I took off something. I took off, I was naked. So the next day, the man of the house said, "We have another project for you that's inside." I was glad that God spared me to be born not during slavery. Mm-hmm. I would have been a Kunta Kinte with both feet gone. Okay, and it may be because I have this experience that I can, in fact, say that. But I think that everywhere we went, we made an impression. Whether it was something small, it was good. If it was something big, we left something big there for them to grow even bigger. Okay? Great. So that's my story. Okay?
Great.
Thank you. Thank you, everybody.
Yeah. Okay, so now the floor is open. If you'd like, if you've listened to everyone speak, and what they've said, if you have questions to ask them, please do.
Let me just add, it is 12:30, which is on the schedule. That's when we're scheduled for lunch.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, we can decide what we want to do about that, but during... Let's see.
What time are we meeting again?
We're meeting at 2. Now, obviously, we could spend a lot more time. I feel like I have questions. I have other things.
I've got questions too,
but
they're short.
You know, there's a lot planned here. It's going to take a committee decision to decide to act something else that's in the schedule, to schedule more time for these groups to meet again. You know, and I don't know if that's going to happen or not.
Well, why don't we just
take a little time right now,
15 minutes.
That we might not have any more time.
Yeah.
And then we'll see what the general.
Everybody might not
is.
Have questions, but if you do, ask it of that person, and then you set your clock for your smartphone for 20 minutes. How's that? Is that fair?
I want to continue. My wife is probably in the hospital. I want to make the call.
Please go ahead. Yes, please go ahead.
I'll set this.
Is everybody satisfied with 20 minutes? Okay.
Sure. I didn't quite hear the beginning of your 20 minutes for
us to total. Ask then each other questions.
20 minutes total for a kind of open discussion, asking questions of
asking
each other.
Questions based on what their story was.
I had one thought in that we're going to have a banquet tonight, and if we could pick up something that sort of tied us over here, we could then go on till 2 o'clock.
Well, let's do it now. We're wasting time asking that. Let's do our 20 minutes, okay? Well, let's get everybody agreed to 20 minutes. If you have some questions to ask somebody of what they said, let's do it.
Okay, fine. All right.
Should we just go around again, or does anyone just want to?
Well, just raise. Jennifer?
Yes.
I had a comment to say to you. The reason the black lady chose to go ahead and do was because all the other black women were already maids and laundress and ironers, and she couldn't get another one. So she had to back off of what?
That was Kathy.
Oh, was that Kathy? Okay.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. She had to back off. And in a lot of cases, it was the husbands that were fired, not the wives, because the wives cleaned up the houses, and the white wives weren't going to tolerate their husbands taking away their thing. Okay. I had with Charles. Mm-hmm. 2/3 of the black population were registered.
No.
They were, because you said trying to vote.
Yep.
And my question was, well, were they registered? Yep. So they weren't registered.
Okay. Charles Buell, Surrey County. I probably wasn't as clear as I should have been.
Mm-hmm.
The total black-white population of Surrey was 2/3 black, 1/3
mm-hmm.
white.
Mm-hmm.
Within that black population, and I'm talking about real numbers here, mm-hmm. there were about 150 to 200 blacks who were already registered
mm-hmm.
when we came.
Mm-hmm.
They ended up with well over 1,000, but
mm-hmm.
We didn't start from zero the way other counties did. Does that clarify? I think we ended up registering about 200 people, and I would just echo your concluding remarks about the impact that we had in the summer of 65. There was a positive impact, and we were very much aware that the strong black leadership in Surrey had been active before.
Mm.
I think we gave them an extra push.
Yeah.
But when we left, there were only 500. They had to register 500 more before before they got enough votes to actually take control. And they did get help from another organization called the National Association of Southern Poor.
Oh.
Which I hadn't heard of.
Me either.
Charles Petaway, who was one of the big leaders there, was the first president of Surrey County's chapter of that. And I think, and certainly the guy who ran this was very savvy in not only getting people registered, but getting out the vote in the day and so forth like that. As I mentioned, these people, these strong leaders in 1965 ended up running the county and, from all accounts, running it very well in the 70s and 80s and into the 90s.
Any other questions you have?
I have a comment, and then maybe I can throw something open.
Oh, thank you. Kathy Lass. Lanny, you mentioned that one organization, or one man, even totally dominated the county. We had, on a smaller scale, I think, a vending machine company that employed just about every black person in the county. That's an exaggeration, but they were very powerful. And each week, the folks would show us their check stubs, and they were different every week. They would pay them one thing one week, something else another week. We sat down one day, this would never happen today, and we sat down at Mrs. Blow's table and called the Wage Hour Administration in D.C. And we said, this is the situation, this is who we are. In 2 weeks, they were down there and investigated and ordered the owner to give back pay. I don't know how you dealt with one economic power that was so large. Did you have any dealings with Washington?
This is Lanny. As I mentioned, after all our efforts to get the registrar to open up the hours, we're not successful, other than galvanizing the people and getting people out willing to risk it. We had to drive to D.C. because we were in Virginia, so we weren't that far. We drove to D.C. to the Justice Department. We met with them, and they contacted the county and told them, you know, we're going to basically shut you down and take over your operation if you don't make registration more available to people. And it took the Voting Rights Act passing for us to be able to do that. But remember, this was all in the wake of President Kennedy's administration. Now, Johnson was in there. The federal government was pro-civil rights then. That was our saving grace. And while I have the mic, and then it looks like Peggy wants, I wanted to add a couple of things about the legacy that we left there. First, I'll tell you, there was an incident. Were you in the restaurant? I'll let Peggy tell the restaurant story. But you were not in the car. Two of our people, white workers, Elke Wiedenroth and Gary Imsland, were out at one of the many weeknight church meetings that we went to introduce ourselves and to pitch voting and organize, help organize. They were driving home in the dark, late at night, from a meeting way out in the pine forest to one of these rural churches, and this truck started chasing them. And trying to run them off the road. So they started driving faster. The truck started driving faster. Then the guys in the truck stuck a rifle out the window. So they drove as fast as they could back to town. And once they got under the streetlights, they recognized the truck. This was a small town. They recognized the guys in the truck. So we had a meeting with Colton and decided that they should press charges. I don't remember exactly what the charges were, but assault with a vehicle, brandishing a weapon, and so on. So there was a trial. And the judge was obviously so prejudiced against us that when Elke went on the stand, he asked her her name. She was a white German girl. He asked her where she lived, and she said with the... I think it was the Andrews family, and he said, is that the Andrews on Route 301? She said, yes. He said, they're colored, aren't they? She said, yes. He said, are you white or colored? So that was the tone of this courtroom, and I felt the most threatened the whole time I was there, sitting in that courtroom with all the white people there, just feeling like they're going to come up with something before I walk out of here to throw me in jail. So finally, these guys admitted that they were in the truck. Our workers recognized the truck. It seemed like an open and shut case until the defense attorney for the guys, asked our workers to state the exact year, make, and model of the truck.
Oh, please.
Which they were not able to state, and so the judge threw it out for lack of evidence. Yeah. So the judge threw it out for lack of evidence. So after we left at the end of the summer, the school year was starting, there were two protests. The parents protested the unsafe busing conditions for the kids, and the district added 6 new buses. Even more importantly, these teenagers that had been our allies, the kids that we worked with, one of them was a leader. He's now a pastor. He's now a minister there in Virginia. Horace Lee Jones. He organized a march of all the kids from the different towns who were all being bused out to the center of the county to integrate their school so they didn't have to go out to that school anymore. And they integrated the schools.
Wonderful.
So by the time we went back the next summer, the schools had been integrated.
This was in the fall of 65 or 66?
65.
I want to ask a question for everybody. I'm Rugsy Ruggiero. He had an incident with the Klan. You got shot at. You just gave that story. The lady I stayed with, Sarah Small, they burnt a cross where I lived. Jesse Jackson came up and moved me out of that town to another town. I'm curious, the other people, if I could find out what those were. And that you can give your story that you were going
about
to.
About the restaurant.
Kathy Lass, thanks. We weren't attacked directly, although we had several close calls. Okay. And one time Jennifer and I were together. This big corporation in Virginia that employed so many blacks had picnics once a year. One day was the white picnic, and then the colored picnic was the next day. Of course, the four of us went to the colored picnic, and we borrowed somebody's pickup truck, and we had forgotten something, and we walked back. We had parked quite a while away, and when we got there, there were two young white toughs making comments to us, and my heart was beating, I remember that. We're out in the middle of nowhere, and we had been followed by a black gentleman who wanted to keep an eye on us. Mm-hmm. And he just came out of nowhere and told these two white kids to get the hell out.
Right.
And he scared them, and they did. And he said to us, "Don't you ever go off by yourselves mm-mm. like that again." It was a stupid thing to do, but mm-hmm. we were not thinking, and we were naive. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And, of course, we got called names. And the house we were staying in got shot at mm-hmm. once, but...
But that brought the FBI down.
That brought the FBI down, yes, yeah.
This is Michelle to Ruggiero. You seem to think you did little, but many black people, even today, don't know who to call, you know, about their problems, and you passed it on to the authorities. So you taught those black people what the next step is. Success, you know.
Thank you.
I just have a very short Charles Beale from Surrey. While we had very few incidents in Surrey, and we were happy for that, but 2 years later, I got letters that there were crosses burned in Surrey. So the reaction was building up. We were trailed a couple of times. There was an early election in early August, right after the voting rights bill was passed, and I was a poll watcher with one of the people there, and about every 5 minutes, this middle-aged man with his new Thunderbird would just drive by our place and watch us come around, and then 5 minutes later, he'd come by again. Okay. This guy had enough money to drive a Thunderbird. He wasn't going to get violent and ruin his car, but he was keeping an eye on things, too. Yeah. So I still remember the directional signals. It had a little light like that, going across like that. I remember seeing it. I did not have the problems of others, but behind it all, there was definitely... and you need to be aware of that.
You've been interrupted.
No, this is Peggy Poole. Actually, Lanny, maybe I'll let you tell the story about the restaurant. I wanted to say something about the situation for the young black people in Waverly. Sussex had three towns, but these were Waverly was the largest, but these were little towns. And in the black area of town, there was like one main unpaved street kind of curled around. And so the white young people for entertainment, or it was sadistic, but they would do something called fishing, where they would drive through, they'd get drunk probably, but on a Friday or Saturday night, drive down slowly down through the black area of town. And these were poor people. They living in shacks, mm-hmm. and a lot of them did not have running water. There were outhouses out and back. Mm-hmm. There were people that were just struggling to get along. And these kids would come down in their cars with fishing pole and put a big hook on the end and try to snag young black people or anyone actually that was out walking. And this was something that was talked about there. I mean, it was really terrorism. It was terrorism. Yeah. Yeah, that was a new one. That you couldn't imagine. So it's, you know, while I was in the South for most of the time, there was some degree of anxiety and fear. But again, I just can't state enough my admiration for the people that lived there and what they had quietly put up with and were no longer putting up with, but in a nonviolent, a very positive, these were church-going people, and just the amount of respect that I had for them and have for them now.
Amen. Yeah, and just this is Lanny Coffer. Just on a personal note, I think we probably all experienced something like what I experienced living in the homes with people. I'd only once before been in a black person's home, and that was the maid that worked for my family, and my mother, my father had passed away, and my mother was you know, very, very kind to her, and we went down to visit. She was sick, and we went down into downtown LA. But so this was a new experience for me, and you know, the people that housed us were not generally the people who worked for Garland Gray. They just couldn't risk that. But there was one man who we did stay with, who was a heavy equipment operator in the a forklift operator in the mill, and maybe because his skills were needed, he was willing to take us in, and they did not retaliate against him. He was a well loved and well respected man, but that the love that we experienced among the people there for each other, the way they all took care of each other, but also the generosity mm-hmm. toward us. Mm-hmm. Which they had so little, but mm-hmm. every time we went in somebody's Shit. House, they offered us that Southern hospitality. Mm-hmm. You know, so many experiences that really mm-hmm. had a spiritual effect on me mm-hmm. more than the actual preaching in the churches. I saw the love. I experienced that love. But this one incident, and Peggy was there, several of our people, early on when we got there in July, early July, a mixed group went to this restaurant, not with the intention of purposely desegregating the restaurant. I'm not even sure if there was even a sign that said white only. It was just understood that black folks went around to mm-hmm. the back. Mm-hmm. So they went in, they sat down, and they were just simply ignored. Mm-hmm. Nobody ever came to take their order. And they asked and they waited and they mm-hmm. waited. And finally, the owner, a woman, it was called Virginia's Restaurant. Virginia mm-hmm. came out and told them, I'm sorry, we're closing. Mm-hmm. I think it was the middle of the afternoon.
And she didn't say, I'm sorry.
Oh, she didn't say, I'm sorry. Thank you for clarifying that. That's why I thought you should tell the story. She said, we're closing. And they finally left. And this is in my presentation that I'm going to share tomorrow afternoon at mm-hmm. lunchtime, because we have a newspaper clipping mm-hmm. from not the local newspaper, they were not too sympathetic, but from the Petersburg Progress Index, the mm-hmm. nearest, more metropolitan newspaper, a picture of her standing outside her restaurant, which she closed for good, mm-hmm. rather than risk having to be desegregated and everything else. She closed her restaurant. She had a big, huge sign made that said, closed on account of niggers. And she put that sign out in front of her restaurant and posed with the sign for the newspaper photo, which I share in my presentation.
Shot herself in the foot.
That was the restaurant.
This is Michelle to Alan. Alan, you mentioned that the business people called the Klan. in most places, the business people were the Klan. Did they go get their hoods on while the other ones were out there?
Good question. This is Al Campan, and this is about Lunenburg County. The Klan had not been active in that county, and I think probably through most of Virginia, not so active for many years. So in a sense, when I mentioned that some of the leading businessmen had invited the Klan to come in and kind of reestablish operations, I think that's what was going on. But then they definitely participated in the Klan activities, mm-hmm. and the cross-burning and so on. I'd like to leverage off the issue. The question of the participation of the black church, the black religious community. And we saw a distinction in our county between some sort of quote-unquote establishment black churches, which were in the towns, in a couple of the towns of the county, and the rural black churches. And we found much greater welcoming attitude and participation from the rural, the smaller rural county churches, mm-hmm. and that's where we found most of our contacts for lodging arrangements and things like
yes.
that. And whereas the establishment churches were more tied into the white power structure. It was
right,
a very distinct
right.
difference in how
yeah.
much participation
yes.
there was. And one other thing I'd like to kind of cast out a question for others is the issue of school segregation or desegregation. One of the families that I stayed with, I think it was the Maddox family, their daughter was at high school age, and she had made the decision to go to the white school in the fall of 65. And that was a decision that I just, it's hard for me to imagine how much strength that took, not only on the part of the young woman, but also of her family and all of the potential economic consequences that there were. And this was something, and this was not something that that we as Scope volunteers, unless we stayed on, could even affect. And we had to be really, really very careful about trying to encourage people to do that, because there were potential consequences down
yes.
the road. That was
Michelle to Alan. I know you know the Ruby Bridges story, and if you saw the old films, as she was going through this gauntlet of angry white people, there was this one white woman, white young girl, who stood out, you know, shouting at her, spitting on her, the whole works. And a few years ago, because they still show that film, a few years ago, she met with Ruby Bridges, and she apologized. She said that's all she knew. That's what her parents did. That's what she did. And she was now ashamed that she had a chance to go through what was taught her in the real world, you know? So those young girls and young little boys, they went through hell, okay? I know, because I went to predominantly white schools. Okay, I grew up going to predominantly white schools, and I caught hell, okay? I didn't catch hell just from the white kids, but when I got off the trolley to walk home, I caught it from the black kids, okay? So I know what it feels like. So that's why I picked a historically black college to be around.
Teenagers are very socially conscious, and friendships are very important.
Yes, yes.